You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and one of the major themes of this show since its inception nearly 10 years ago has been the impact of globalization on our region's economy, and especially the loss of manufacturing jobs in communities around here, around our region, and in the Midwest region. We've talked a lot about the social impacts and the economic impacts, the political impacts. My guest today has been focusing a lot on solutions, how cities of all sizes, all regions, can try to revitalize their communities. And what I find particularly attractive as a former local official and somebody who's worked in economic development is that his approach is bottom up. It's using existing resources and talent, not waiting around for a huge government grant or one big employer to come to town. So I'm really pleased to welcome back to Heartland Politics, James Fallows. A lot of our listeners are familiar with James. He's a former presidential speechwriter. He's authored 12 books, including his most recent one, which was co-authored with his wife, Deb, who's been very involved in his efforts as well. It's called Our Town. And by the way, I just read where it was made into an HBO documentary. He's written, I'm not going to list all the publications, wide variety, including Washington Monthly, which is one of my favorites. And his most recent piece for Washington Monthly is what we're going to be talking about today. It's called Reviving America One College Town at a Time. James, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
So, Robin, it's a pleasure to join you and your audience. And Deb and I send our best wishes.
Well, again, as a former local official, I really appreciate the work you've done, you and Deb have done, focusing on, solutions. How do communities kind of get themselves up after they've been knocked down, especially a lot of places out here in our region, as you know? We all know the problems. Let's focus on solutions. So what drew you to this piece where you bring together, I think, a very practical solution, which a lot of towns in our listening area with colleges will be interested in hearing about? What kind of brought you to this type of angle on how communities can bring themselves back?
So thanks for asking. I'll give a little bit of big picture context and then talk specifically about what I was writing about in the Washington Monthly, where you are a frequent author as well, and which was actually my very first job in magazine journalism back when I got out of graduate school in the 1970s. So the brief big picture is that Deb and I had been living in China for a number of years, working as writers there. We came back to the U.S. and wanted to try to this not long after the sort of 2008 economic collapse and everything that followed. And so we wanted to start seeing something in the U.S. we'd done in China, which is how the picture of the country looked at the local level, not in the big cities, not Shanghai and Beijing in China, not D.C. and Seattle and L.A. in the United States. And so starting 10 years ago, we began traveling to smaller towns in the U.S. that had suffered some kind of blow. The factory went away, the farms have been consolidated, you name it. All of your listeners are familiar with these blows, and seeing what were the traits that distinguished those who had been able to find a new way ahead. And we did a book about this, as you mentioned, called Our Towns. HBO put out a movie 2 years ago now, which was a great movie, still on HBO Max. And one of the themes that we examined was the role that higher education in all its aspects could play in a community's future. We know about the role of big research universities, and they have a huge effect, but also liberal arts colleges, which can attract a different kind of population to a town, community colleges, which are so important in connecting people who need opportunity with the opportunities that exist. Cooperative programs with K-12 schools and high schools. And so we've been doing a series for the Washington Monthly about case studies of ways in which colleges and universities that might traditionally have thought we're in our own little cloistered moat, we don't care about what's happening in the surrounding community. For example, Muncie, Indiana for Ball State University, or you can give many other illustrations. We looked instead at those who said, as the community goes, our institution goes as well. We can't be separate from the welfare of our surrounding area. And so I was writing most recently about Gannon University in Erie, Pennsylvania, and Colby College in Waterville, Maine.
Yeah, those are, I really like the sizes, because Erie is about around 100,000. They've lost some population, maybe about 95. And so that may be something of interest to like Davenport, Iowa, which is about 100,000. Colby College, Colby is in Waterville, Maine, which is a lot smaller. What's the population there? About 20,000.
Yes, it's in the 20 someplace, but it's that scale of town.
Yeah, so that would appeal to like a Galesburg or a Monmouth, where there's small liberal arts colleges as well. But traditionally, you know, we think of colleges, especially small colleges, as kind of walled off, as kind of their own little community within a community. And that type of thinking really is what a lot of these leaders overcame to get them more involved.
Yes, and I'll give a backstory just briefly about another Midwestern institution, because I think it's quite significant. It's a little bit bigger. That's Muncie, Indiana, which I'm sure many of your listeners have been to and are familiar with. It was the home of the Ball Brothers Canning Empire, and that's why Ball State University has the name it does, because the Ball Brothers gave the land a century ago or so. And so there's Ball State there, which is a large public institution, and there's the town. And Muncie, like many other communities of its scale, it's in the 100,000 range, I guess, in Indiana, had factories leaving, and it had urban decline, it had troubled schools. And the new president of Ball State about 4 or 5 years ago now, a man named Jeffrey Mearns, who had was from the Midwest himself. He was from Ohio. He'd been on the East Coast in many roles, including a district attorney and I think in New York, a federal attorney. He became the president of Ball State, and his proposition to the university was, this university is going to make it or not, depending on whether Muncie makes it or not. That's how we're going to attract students, how we're going to attract faculty, how we're going to make this seem like a going concern. And so in a story I'll just abbreviate, they arranged for something that has no obvious precedent in American history, where the public university, Ball State, also runs the community school system for Muncie, the K-12 system. And this was an elaborate negotiation that the university, the state government, the local citizens of all diverse background put together. And it's also the case that the local newspaper there, like many others, has been in a long sort of hollowing out decline. And the Ball State student newspaper has been effectively the community newspaper now, which is one of many approaches that people are thinking. So Ball State was one illustration of this, of saying that we make it or not, we the university, depending on whether the community makes it or not. The two more recent illustrations I'm giving, one is Gannon University in Erie. Again, Erie, as you say, is about 100,000. Long-term population decline the last 30 or 40 years as big industries have left. It's quite a diverse community now. It has a large refugee proportion in its population. Gannon was founded about a century ago by a man that was named for somebody who became the Catholic Archbishop in Erie. And its mission was to give opportunities to people who might be left behind by the snootier higher ed establishment of 100 years ago. And its current president, who's announced his departure as a relatively young man, Keith Taylor, said, again, this is our mission. It's, some people might say, he put it as part of his program, as Gannon goes, so goes Erie. But instead, he said, as Erie goes, so goes Gannon. That if we want to grow as they have, if we want to become a strong institution, we have to be in a vibrant place. And so Gannon has invested tremendously in having new buildings and dormitories downtown in some distressed areas of Erie, of connecting its curriculum with the problems of the city, of having students work on housing renovation or all the other woes of a industrial town, of having a Great Lakes emphasis for some of its science courses, and just with the idea that the Great Lakes are the one part of the U.S. likely to be, quote, favored, unquote, by climate change. that they're the source of fresh water, their climate will become milder. And so Gannon has been making itself successful as a private university and the center of the town's renovation, you know, through all the things it's been doing. So that's the story of, that's a brief story of Gannon and Erie. Shall I go on to talk about Colby and Waterville?
Yeah, go right ahead. This is the second town, the focus of James's latest piece in the Washington Monthly.
So Waterville, Maine, is like many other smaller towns in the Northeast where it had been a big mill community. I believe arrow shirts or something like that was were made there. There were paper mills, of course, like much of the Maine coast. And it was something that a century ago had a big, vibrant blue-collar community through the mill empires of the U.S. in the textile and the clothing and the pulp and paper and all the other industries that, again, the upper Midwest would know very well, too. And over the decades, most of those factories have gone away, and that downtown Waterville had suffered the kind of erosion that, again, I don't need to detail or elaborate for many of your listeners. Colby College, a relatively well-known small private institution, embraced as its founding, not myth, but founding story, that a century ago, the citizens of Waterville had rescued Colby College. Colby then had a very cramped location. It was between like the railroad yards and some other constraint, like, you know, a river or something, and they couldn't grow. And the people who were leading Colby a century ago thought, in order to survive and make it, we're going to have to go someplace else. We may have to move to Augusta, Maine. And the citizens of Waterville, blue-collar mainly, came up with what was then, what was for them at the time, a huge amount of money. I forget the amount now, $100,000, something like that. But it was a giant sum for that community in those days to buy the new site on a hillside where Colby is to this day. So over the last decade, the leader, the president of Colby, David Green, has said, it's time to repay the karmic balance. Again, there was the specific karmic connection of Waterville saved Colby, Colby can help Waterville. And there was, so there was that, that's a Colby specific narrative, but also there was the sense that if this college is to make it, we have to make our city be a place where students and faculty and administrators want to be. That students who might be going to other liberal arts colleges in the East Coast, the Midwest, even the West Coast, they would think, well, Colby has a certain appeal because it's in this town. It's not apart from that town, even though the campus, newer campus, was a couple miles away, but it is of this town. And at least as important from Green's point of view is that for a liberal arts college whose appeal involves a community that students want to be part of and not just feel like a commuter school, although commuter schools have their advantages, that the student, the faculty and the staff members would also have to feel that this was not a place they drove to and from in the working day, but a place where they lived and where the professors might run into the students on the street or in a coffee shop or perish the thought in a bar. And so that was part of the big investment that Colby College under David Green made over the last decade of raising a tremendous amount of money for what became like a $100 million investment in downtown Waterville. A new art center, which just opened 2 or 3 months ago, dormitories for students to live right downtown. So they would get up every day and spend their day in the community. And the students, it became a competitive thing for students to apply for these places. And as part of it, they had to have some research project they were doing on downtown Waterville and making the city, this small community, feel not like one more left behind community, but one more place that, like its college, was attractive. That communities, by definition, need to draw new people in if they're going to survive. And communities, community colleges, liberal arts colleges, everybody else needs to do that too. So those are two illustrations of what I think is can become a trend of town and gown where Gown feels it needs to work with Town for both of them to survive.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is James Fallows, who's written a very interesting piece called Reviving America, One College Town at a Time. James has written 12 books. He's co-authored a book with his wife, Deb, called Our Town, which was made into an HBO documentary. You really, if you're interested, I would encourage listeners to go pick up this edition of Washington Monthly or access it online and even subscribe. They always have provocative pieces in there that are very practical and solutions based. And that's been the focus of James's work throughout the years, which, again, I appreciate as somebody focused at the local level on solutions to a lot of these problems. I'm really curious. You discussed in your piece some of the, I would say, what Keith Taylor, the president of Gannon, talked about, lessons learned or some practical guidelines. Listed four of them. Can you discuss those a little bit? Because I think that offers kind of a path for people really thinking about this.
Yes, thanks very much. And so I will ask, I'll rely on you, Robin, to cue me on the list of four, because it's been a while since, if you cue me on the list, I will then riff on what each of them is.
Well, one was geographic concentration.
Yes. And so there's ways in which this era is in many ways beyond geography. We know that information is global. People have economic trends and finance are global. Everything happens, instantly. But places that are going to survive need an acute sense of that place, that this town is a place where people want to be. And we're going to think of policies that make it attractive for people to stay there and start businesses there and raise their families there. So this place-based awareness is one thing that Gannon with Erie was doing. And it meant, in terms of their work in Erie, it was recognizing that there was one particular part of the city. I think it's called the West Bayfront, which, number one, was right next to where Gannon was, and number two, had become acutely distressed. So Keith Taylor was saying that for Gannon, as opposed to having region-wide efforts, although they had some, like the Great Lakes, as opposed to thinking of things that were dispersed, they would say, this is our community for the university, our community for the town. And there was a rationale to it, of having this plotted out area. And they had lots of advanced mapping tools they used with the mapping company Esri. And so that awareness of, we are here, our work is here, and we're going to concentrate on this place, that was one of the things that he relied on.
Another was, and I wonder about this, is sustained involvement, where you documented where this can't be just a two-year, three-year thing, and then you lose attention, go to something else, or interest dies out, or whatever. And I imagine there's a big risk of that.
That was a really interesting and revealing comment from my point of view from Keith Taylor, saying that you have students come in for a college, and that's a four-year college there at Gannon. So as first-year students, they say, oh, look at all the things we can do. And then in their second and third years, they're really getting ahead of steam of working with certain professors, getting connections in the community. Then in their fourth year, they're ready to think about something else. And they're thinking what they're going to do next. Some of them are moving elsewhere. Some of them are getting married. Some of them are going to graduate school. Some are starting jobs. And so Keith Taylor was saying there was a predictable cycle of sort of not necessarily boom and bust, but attention and distraction. So he was looking for ways to make, from the community's point of view, a sustained connection with what was happening in the university. And this involved having professors and all people in the faculty set up ongoing programs. And the people, as students who were in their second or third year, would bring in those who were in their first or second year and say, this is something that's going to be ongoing. Because we all know that phenomenon. I can think back long ago, I had friends in the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps, they'd go someplace, they'd be there for a year or two, then they would leave. And it just, there's lots of other institutions where that is true. And so Keith Taylor was saying it really matters to have a continual presence, and to build the institutional reinforcement that would make it not just a handful of students who had a big idea, but an ongoing bond between Gown and Town.
The next one was emphasis on highly practical. And it got me to thinking of a question that you can maybe, as you discuss this bullet point, kind of incorporate. But was there any pushback among folks like within the university? I mean, I've heard this in respectful ways. Their feeling is the college education should be focused on somewhat more academic things, not as much on the practical side. Did they have pushback among trustees or other folks internally?
I'm sure they did, and I'm sure they had more than Keith Taylor in his sayonara time there was telling me all about. And I know that's the case for Jeff Mearns at Ball State as well. But all the three leaders I'm talking about, who all happen to be, you know, men in their sort of 50s era, I would you know, 50s age bracket as opposed to 1950s, they're all very forceful leaders. And it became clear that as part of their job, when they started out at their respective universities, Jeff Mearns at Ball State, Taylor at Gannon, and David Green at Colby, part of their job and their self-assignment for the first year or two was building consensus of having the trustees and the board and the community and the faculty all feel as if this was the mission of the university. And in all of them, this is, it's true of Erie and Muncie in a way that's separate from Waterville, in that Erie and Muncie are both Midwestern industrial communities with diverse populations racially, more than this case for Waterville, Maine. And so involving the community across racial borders was a very, very important part of the consensus building effort in all of these places. And the presidents, especially Mearns and Muncie and Taylor and Gannon, spent some time saying what it was involved in making sure members of the community felt this was their project as well. And they were not just objects of this, of these new visions, but were helping. They were advising it. They were cautioning about it. They were going to share from it, from its success. So I think, yes, there was pushback. And part of the success was the university leaders taking the time to work with all the different constituencies and have them think our shared future is involved in the future of the community in general, these particular parts. And that's true if you're talking about the English department or the drama department or the music department. We all are going to make it or not as the community makes it or not.
This sounds like it's so highly dependent, not just on money, but leadership, both from the college or university and the community. There's, as you know, I mean, there is sometimes a little, you know, pushback and some disagreements on the towns, feeling like that, you know, the college comes in with you know, maybe litter issues and parking issues, things like that. So it's a big job sometimes to sell that to the community as well, to work together.
It's true. And I think that's part of the practicality you were mentioning as one of the morals from Keith Taylor, which is that things like litter from students and like, you know, drinking parties on the weekends or whatever, those are practical consequences of a college's or university's impact on a town that its leadership need to be aware of. And also the kinds of things that Keith Taylor was talking about in Erie, of having potholes repaired and having sidewalks repaired and having tree planting and flower planting and all these kinds of things, and street lighting that sound, they are not highly interesting conceptual approaches, but the kinds of things that affect how people live, where they feel comfortable, where they want to go, and how communities make it.
I related to Waterville and how you mentioned in the piece how the completion of a major highway outside of town and a lot of development moved from downtown right out to the highway. And we see that all over here. And that leaves the downtown empty, but that's also creates these incredible opportunities. And when I had you on my show several years back, you talked about how communities tried to fill that niche. And it creates big opportunities for entrepreneurs to create small businesses downtown.
Oh, it certainly does. And we know that that era of, there's a lot the 1950s through 1970s have to answer for in terms of the look of American cities. The horrible architecture that you can think of as 1970s bank buildings, the destruction of a lot of the beautiful 19th century and pre-World War II downtown architecture, building parking lots and all of that, and the freeways that skirted around or divided historic downtown. So that is what is to be answered for. But there also, as you say, is there a lot, there is opportunity, and you find in these communities that are making it, sort of building by building in the downtown, you can see, the bookstore or the bicycle store or the toy store or the restaurant or the coffee shop or the hotel or all these signs, no one of which is grandiose. But together, they're the symptoms of the makings of a place where people want to be. And if I think that that's something that's important about all the places we've mentioned is moving students downtown. So the students will be there to go to the restaurants and the students will be there to have their parents come visit. And yes, there are things that can be, quote, annoying, unquote, to older people about having, kids these days downtown with their music and their noise. But they're the markers of a place that is growing. So I think in a lot of we all know the looks of a downtown that has lost that glue, that energy of people who are wanting to be there. And lots of universities are using their throw weight to be able to bring back traffic in the human sense, not the car sense, but and students, parents, faculty members, staff, if they want to be downtown, it can make a huge difference.
Final question. We just have a minute left here. And we had Gannon's president, Keith Taylor's kind of lessons learned. What's your observation, James, on this? If listeners out there, a community leader or a college leader think, boy, this is interesting, what's kind of the first step or two they have to do?
That's a fascinating question. First step would be to get this issue of the Washington Monthly, as you say. But I think then to recognize the two-part sales and vision process. One is having the university or college feel that this is our collective challenge to embrace the community. And the second part of that is to identify the leaders of all the different parts of the community and have them feel it is their/our opportunity too. And so recognizing that it's a multi-year process, but it begins with the college internally thinking this is what the future means, and then also making the community feel it's our opportunity too.
James Fallows, thank you very much for being our guest today on Heartland Politics. James is the author of a recent article in Washington Monthly called Reviving America, One College Town at a Time. I thought it was very interesting and worth our listeners hearing, especially in our area here where we have a lot of communities that fit this profile. James, thank you again. I'll be watching for your work in the future and hope to have you back on.
Robin, thanks so much. I'm glad to be here again.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.